Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague in the studio is Joe King. We are broadcasting live this evening at PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are preempted this evening on WBAI, and we're going to start off with something that happened last week, and that was Amazon.
Well, you know, last week, Hank, we talked about the fact that Amazon represents or carries maybe a third of all the Internet traffic in this country. And they went down. They disappeared. They weren't there. And there was a lot of rumors. What caused it? Was it ISIS? Was it the Republican Party? Was it the Democrats? Well, no, the answer finally came out this week. It was the fault of a single engineer, a poor guy who made one mistake in keying in the code to take down a segment of the network for repairs, and instead of taking down three or four servers in the subsystem, he took down a third of the subsystem. And talk about being embarrassed. You know, this always happens when you think you got everything covered, and then you... Well, Hank made the analogy to me. You put a dollar in the machine because you want a Coke, and you get a Sprite instead.
Well, you know, let me just say that the Amazon had announced that their outage was 4 hours. Let me tell you, that's from their point of view because it impacted other networks. In other words, they got up and running in 4 hours, and they said it was a four-hour outage. But I had experienced more the outage beyond that. You know what this is like? It's like you had an operation, and the doctor comes out of the operating room and says the operation was a success, but the patient is in recovery in ICU, and, hey, that's not the finish of it yet. There's more to come.
It's the old story, and it frequently comes up that we say, oh, it wasn't the computer's fault. It was human error, or it was operator error.
Well, I would say it's a combination because as much as you try to eliminate human error by designing it so it wouldn't happen, it does happen. And, you know, one of the things that we always talk about is backing up. And although our emphasis on backing up data, there are other factors when, we do touch on it, such as backing up your equipment, such as... Your electrical source to power the equipment. We do talk about UPS and backup there. But there's another area of backup that I asked Marty Winston to talk about, and I had him address the following.
We have a common theme each week, backup, backup, and backup your data. I asked Marty Winston to add to it the need for backing up your communications environment if you're operating in real-time mode and communications is essential.
What will you do when one WAN won't do? And I really think this is more common than a lot of people realize. In dealing with our 40-year house, 40yearhouse.com has information about that proof of concept project. One of the things we ran into was redundancy, backups, backup, backup, backup. And we heard that somewhere before. Hey, Hank, backup, 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 right? Yes, you have to back up everything you possibly can because failure is inevitable, right? Everything fails sometime or another. So we started looking at having the cable modem, which provides an internet connection through the cable company, and a fiber modem, which handles internet connection through one of the phone companies. In my case, it's AT&T, but you may, your mileage may vary. When you have two WANs available, how do you handle the two of them? Is there any sense to splitting separate networks? Is there any sense to just throwing a big switch and going from one to another? When one is not doing what you want, you go to the other? Well, there are easier answers, and cleverly easier answers, in multiple WAN routers. Routers that can handle two, sometimes more, but right now let's just settle for two WAN, wide area network connections. the thing that goes upstream to the guy who hooks you to the backbone of the internet eventually, and then to everything else you want to be. The great thing about dual WAN routers, and they can have as many LANs as they happen to have, but you're looking for dual WAN, WAN, W-Y-L, LAN, local. If they have two WANs, odds are pretty close to sure that they have the ability to balance traffic on the WANs. They fill one pipe, they fill another pipe, they kind of balance it out so you're never underloaded. You're always getting the max you can get by going their separate ways over the separate connections. And that means sense of balance. This is so just obvious and lovely. The sense of balance says that if one fails, the whole load goes to the other one. It's automatic fallover without having to engage any fallover. So you've got two WANs. You're getting the total of bandwidth of both. And if the bandwidth of one, for any reason, turns into zero, if you've lost that one connection, your total bandwidth is still the other one. You still have a connection to the internet through the other one. There aren't many times, there are a few, but there aren't many times when both a cable modem service and a fiber service will fail. Hurrah, hurrah. Now, what about the LAN? And we've covered the outside, the fact that you can connect to the outside and blah, 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 and it falls back and you're safe and backup, backup, backup. What about the LAN? What are you going to do with that LAN? Well, obviously, the first thing you do is network address translation. It's what a router does. It protects you. So direct access to your inside IP addresses is all but impossible. It's your first kind of junior firewall level of protection against guys getting into you. Not that you can't abandon that by doing dumb things when you're browsing, but that at least gets you started. Now, how many LANs can you have and how many should you have? In our environment, we want to have four LANs, four local area networks. One of those LANs connects outside any other kind of conditioning at all, just straight to Wi-Fi. And it is the guest Wi-Fi network. Unsecured, unprotected, so be it. One LAN is secured through a firewall, is protected, does have its own Wi-Fi, and that is the production LAN for most of what we need to do with our computers and tablets and so on. And then there are two other LANs. They're kind of special. One of those, and these are both intranet, I-N-T-R-A, meaning they only are networking inside the walls. Our two intranets only get one port connected to the outside world, the port that carries NTP, the network time protocol, because with that port, we can maintain synchronization between things in the real world and things on the intranet. And for the things we're doing, that's kind of a good thing to do. One of those LANs where we are is a gigabit LAN connected to the surveillance cameras. And that's just about where you want that. POE, power over Ethernet, is how we connect surveillance cameras. So having a LAN connected to them that does not go to the outside world means the hackers in Russia can't take a peek at all of our account info on the screens that we're showing or on paper that came in the mail or anywhere else. There's no using indoor camera. We don't have indoor cameras anyway. All cameras are outdoors because of that concern. They also can't tell who's entering, who's leaving. None of that stuff. It's a more secure way to live. The other LAN, the other intranet that only connects, again, for the time signal, the NTP port, the other one is where we connect all of our automation systems. And there's close to 100 automation-related computers in our project house. By keeping them on their own LAN, they are never starved. They get their own gigabit switch. They get their own gigabit backbone internally to route on. And they never have to share that with the surveillance system. So the cameras get all the bandwidth they need. The computers get all the bandwidth it needs. And they're never stepping on each other's toes. For the times they have to go outside, they don't. It's the production PCs or it's the guest network that goes outside. these guys don't talk to each other. These four internal local area intranets don't talk to each other at all. Two of them talk to the outside, the other two stay inside. Have you thought of being secular with your networking? Then you're not a geek. What we need to do is to think in terms of what keeps us going, and what we need to do is think in terms of what lets us keep stopping the guys who are going after what we have. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. And I might add that redundancy of equipment should not be sharing the same backup power unit. With the recent Amazon Web Services outage, make sure that backup services are independent of each other and there is no linkage between services, if at all possible. Hey, Joe, you have your 2 cents you want to put in? Because I could see you wanting to say something.
I think, Hank, that most of the people who are listening to us don't really get involved in this type of intranet working or internet working. They should know about what's happening around them, though. If you want to set up, as I have, a computer with a disk drive, because I don't really like to go out into the cloud, and I have a computer with a multi-terabyte disk drive, and I can come in from outside to my computer, and then my computer can access that computer, and I think I'm terribly secure. Well, if you just listen to what Marty had to say, I'm not terribly secure. I still have to build in redundancy. I still have to build in firewalls. I still have to build in security.
Well, that's only if the communications is essential to what you do. In other words, if you're running a small business or you happen to have a project that is very, very important, you really need it because, you know, it's almost like saying it's like you're doing a thesis, okay, and you happen to be in a remote area and you have to have it finished by, let's say, tomorrow, and you find that the way that you had planned on it was to transmit it, but if that communication means is no longer available or down, you can't transmit it. You'll be hard pressed to say, well, how come I didn't have another line?
It's a very simple thing. Think of it as not a network, but just your office, and you sit two doors away from Hank. And you want Hank to be able to help you on something, so you get up and you walk over to his office, except he's out to lunch. What's your backup plan if Hank is out to lunch? I have a backup plan. I don't let him go to lunch until I'm finished with my projects.
You know, one of the things that happened yesterday was that there was a big dump of information from WikiLeaks, And I don't have a chance. I haven't had a chance to go through over 7,000 pages. But one of the things that that almost everyone was talking about was if you have a smart TV, it could be spying on you. You know what? And the reason is because when we put everything on a network, we think of it as one network. Whether it has to be, whether you need the internet or not, you're still using this. You know, that this one big network that happens to have the internet on it. Now, you hook up your smart TV. Now, in my case, I have a smart TV, but it's not connected at all. And so, therefore, there's nothing being transmitted. But if it was because you have this one network, hey, you know what? This is one of the things that we talked about a week or 2 weeks ago about the Internet of Things. That's how things can become insecure, because you have one network and it's everything is all put on it.
You know, it's very easy to do multiple networks at home. You have a simple LAN to connect your computer, your children's, your wife's, your next-door neighbors. And then you have another computer network to handle the cloud storage that you're doing, the terabyte storage. And then you can have even another one if you want one just to handle nothing else but your financials, because you don't want that tied into anything else for security. But we don't do that. I don't do that.
Yeah, because everyone thinks of a communication as being one network. They put everything on it, whether it's needed or not. And you'll find that with a lot of your local information, just smart TV and things like that, it doesn't have to be on this network that connects to the outside world. You don't need it.
It's getting more and more complicated just to exist.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, Joe, you know, you're an old-timer like me, and I was very sad to hear that Popular Photography on March the 10th will be publishing their last issue. And I know that when I mentioned that to you, you said, wow, that's 80 years and it's gone?
It's interesting. I'm not into photography as much as you are and some of my other friends are, but I've been looking at it, and Pop Photography has now gone. Think of all the computer magazines you used to read. They're all gone.
No, there's still two or three there.
And they're not what they used to be.
No. In the old days, PC, what is it? You got PC World and you got PC Computing, okay?
PC Magazine.
PC Magazine would be published twice a month. And it'd be like 300-400 pages in each issue, which 90% was all ads.
Well, they actually had 14 issues to PC Magazine, and two of them were what we called the humongous issues. One was the humongous printer issue. It was 400 or 500 pages. And you didn't want it really for the articles. Yes, it reviewed some printers, and they had a very excellent computer lab. As a matter of fact, our colleague Alfred Poor was involved with that. But the problem was that in those days, computers were very complicated things, and printers to be hooked into them were very complicated things. And today, it's a matter of a toaster oven.
You know what? It actually is as complicated as it was before, because now you have all the insecurity, and you have a network, and it's like the wide open West where there is no security.
But
and the problem is, people are not even aware that they are affected by it.
And since they're not aware, they don't care, and they don't worry about it, and they just go about their daily business. Yes, occasionally they get hit with a piece of ransomware, and they're destroyed, and their lives are over. And occasionally things like malware gets in, and it stops their production line from working. But for the most part, people at home who use computers are not concerned about it. People in business, people in corporations, they're concerned about it. They have to be.
Well, I think this is also another example where Popular Photography, and then there was another major publication, Modern Photography, going out of business is because they really did not go through the transition, because photography is not dead, because in the year 2010, oh, boy, there was like over 40 million cameras sold. It was huge. And yet there is a site called DP Review, which is digitalphotographyreview.com. And it's a heavily visited site. So I think a big part of the problem is that the subject itself didn't change, but the technology changed. And if you don't move with it, you're going to be left behind.
But this wasn't a case of the technology being the problem. This was back to the case of the horseless carriage. A lot of companies were left making buggy whips, but the horseless carriage didn't have a horse. Let me ask you a question. Let me see a show of hands. Everybody in the audience who has a camera, raise your hand. There's a lot of you.
If you have a phone, almost everyone said that they have a camera.
Right. Now I'm going to say everybody who has a camera in their telephone, lower your hand. All right. Now you two people that are left with the standing there with your hands up, what kind of a camera do you have?
Well, one of the things that is tied in with another news item that came out is that it was reported in the year 2010, that was the peak sales of digital cameras, and some of the, in fact, I'll tell you who it is, Canon and Nikon really did not change with the times in terms of the platform. They continue with the the platform design of the single lens reflex, and just by putting a digital technology, instead of regular film in it, they continue with that same looking platform, whereas others came up with a different form of it with mirrorless technology. And now Canon and Nikon is trying to catch up with them. And what happened is that Nikon now has announced that they had announced last week that they dropped an entire line because they're in the market late. Canon came up with the M6, which is also late to market. Whether they can catch up or not, we don't know. But the between this year, the 2017 and last year, what do you think the drop in camera sales was in regular point-and-shoot cameras last year? 37%.
Less than I would have thought.
That is huge. And in terms of digital single-lens reflex, it took almost a 20% hit in down. But mirrorless stay flat, so it's there. And one of the things that there's a study that was made, and let me tell you what the study was that I was surprised by. That regular cameras, in other words, other than a smart camera, other than a smartphone with the use of the camera, cameras are for older people, they say, and it's for people 40 years and above.
I would have thought it was even older than that.
And people younger than that, they don't care about cameras. They have what they need in the smartphone, and that's all they do. That's all they use.
What is the purpose of a camera? The basic purpose of a camera
is recording history.
That's
what it is.
The basic purpose of a camera is to take a picture.
Yes.
Now, when you become a professional or an artist or a super technical person, you want to do other things with your camera than just take a picture. You remember back when there were film cameras, they had a whole class of cameras called PhDs, push hair dummy.
No, press hair dummy. we call them PhD cameras.
The point being that I have a Nikon, I have a Canon in the closet, both of them. I have a Pixel in my pocket, and that's what I use for a camera.
Well, Joe, I think that what's happened is that... Well, it's a big change, and I was reading where Nikon is. They made an announcement. Was it last week or early this week that they are going to be in the high-end professional camera area, and they're dropping out of the consumer market. And so all those Coolpix cameras, they're good cameras, and if you like to have a pocket camera, they're going to be. They're going to be dumping them, and they're usable cameras,
But so is the camera I have in my Pixel.
Yeah. Now, I was telling you that if you know anything about older technology, you could take advantage of it. Like I said to you, you have film equipment, and you have a single-lens reflex, and you probably have some interchangeable lens with it, right? And the typical one was a 50-millimeter 1.4 lens or 1.8 lens. You may have a wide-angle 35, 2.8, or f2 lens, and so on. But the question that people would ask is, could you put these lens onto a digital interchangeable lens camera? The answer is yes. The question is, how much would the adapter cost to enable you to mount these lens on? Less than $100 in many cases, or more like $50, $60. Well, then why don't people do it? It's because everything is in manual mode. They think it's in manual mode. Now, what if I told you that if they had given it some thought, it doesn't have to be. They can actually run a manual lens on an interchangeable digital camera in somewhat automatic mode. Did you know that? But people don't think of it, and they don't realize that if you just think about the technology, you can do it.
They don't think about the technology because they don't know about the technology.
For instance, you would say, how would you do it? Well, it's something called hyperfocal distance.
When Hank said that to me, I gave him a very straight, what?
Because, to me, I know the term. I know what it is. I know what technology is. And to many people, it's old stuff, so therefore you don't pay attention to it. Hyperfocal distance, okay? What it is that when you take a picture and when your lens is wide open, the point of focus is normally no more than a foot, you know, from front to back when the lens is wide open, okay? Now, if you turn the lens opening down, you get a wider one so that the background would be in focus with the foreground, and a lot of people do that if you want to, like, have a scenery, okay? Now, if you set it to F8 or F5.6 manually, let's say, you have a greater area of focus. If you move the tail end of that focus of that aperture to infinity, then everything from infinity to some point closer is all in focus. So if you have something like F8, you could probably have everything from 8 feet out to infinity in focus, and you have a set aperture, so you set your high-end digital single-lens reflex to be shutter-dependent, and the shutter will pick the right exposure, and therefore the focusing is done, or you don't have to focus because it's already done, and the shutter will give you, is done by the camera, and you're running in automatic mode. And you know, they're selling these fantastic lens for $40, $50, $20, cheap. And if you want to have it fully automatic, they want $300, $400, $500, $600 for the same lens. I bet you didn't know that.
Let me ask you something else, folks. I want a show of hands. Of those of you who understood what Hank just said, how many of you cared?
Well, if you're buying a high-end camera where, you know, you're talking about a single-lens reflex, and they call them DSLR now, or mirrorless cameras, you're buying it because you have intention of having more than one lens. And then the sticker shock is when you start looking at what it costs to add a telephoto zoom or wide angle or whatever you want, an extra lens. It costs more than the camera itself.
Well, that's absolutely true. Back in the day, I did buy a Nikon for myself, and I had budgeted the several hundreds of dollars that it cost. And I was in a store that incidentally is no longer in business, and they said to me, well, you know, now you got a very good camera with a 50-millimeter lens. What do you want for your zoom, and what do you want for your wide angle, and what do you want for your macro? And I said, I thought I just spent $500 or $600 for a camera. What do I need? And by the time I left the store, I had spent more than the price of the camera.
Yes, but the thing is, in those days, the lens were affordable. Today, when they're over $500 just for, you know, a wide-angle lens, you just say to yourself, I'm such a shock. By the way, when we talk about old technology, some of the terms may be old technology, but they carry forward. Because I said to Joe that there was an announcement made by Google. And what Google said is that people are storing pictures on Google Photo. And Google, starting what 2 days ago, had announced that anytime you store pictures up there, based on the parameters you set, they will automatically set the white balance for you. And I said that to Joe, and Joe said to me, white balance? What are you talking about, right? But white balance is a common term with old technology.
What are you balancing the white with?
Well, first of all, with film photography, you bought daylight film or you bought tungsten film, which is indoor film, and you get a different coloration. Fluorescent lighting would be also a different film. So with digital, because it's handled electronically, it can make the proper adjustment whether it's indoors or outdoors, and this is called Kelvin temperature. In other words, the higher it is in the 5,000 range, or it's called daylight, and when you get down to the 3,000 range, it's called the tungsten. In between, you got all the different kind of lighting, and you know what it is, Joe. It's like you were to take a picture of someone outdoors with tungsten, where they look orange in the face, you know. And this is done now automatically by Google if you just put it up there.
Well, as long as you're talking about Google, I found out that I can take as many pictures as I want and as high a resolution as I want with my Pixel camera. I mean, my Pixel telephone.
Which is Google.
Which is Google. And they would automatically, I don't have to do a thing. As a matter of fact, I don't even know how to do it. They would automatically backup to the cloud, unlimited. They didn't care how many terabytes I uploaded. They would do this so-called white balance correction.
And order with the compliments of presenting the NSA all the information they need.
And without my knowledge.
I know. Isn't that terrible? You know, it's we talk about Google as being the 800-pound monster, or what do you call it? The
gorilla.
Gorilla, that's it. And I know that one of your complaints about Google is, like, you have a Pixel phone, and I'm going to ask you a simple question. Don't you find that the documentation with it is so thorough and comprehensive that it's a model for everyone to follow?
Well, I had been running an Android phone for many years now. I got the new Pixel just about a week or so ago, and I was proud to see that it had the Android Nougat, that is the Android 7, and with the two corrections, so it was a 7.1.1, and I thought that was wonderful because I had been running Marshmallow, which was 6 before that, and I was just sort of curious, what were all the changes and the developments and the new things in it, and nobody would tell me.
Now, wait a minute. Joe, I told you, RTFM, read the fine manual, right?
Well, I don't say the fine manual. I say a different kind of manual.
Listen, we have an audience out there.
I did a Google search for the manual, and I found that Google's recommendation was to go online and read the help files. Well, that made a certain amount of sense. Except the help files weren't set up for reading. They were set up for querying for a specific problem. And then somebody else said, if I go back up and search, I'll find some very interesting things. So I did a search for Android 7 1.1 manual. And I found that a number of companies, commercial companies, for their own employees, had put together a manual.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't studied any of them yet, and I don't know if any of them are.
And, you know,
worthwhile.
Google's business model is they come up with a product. It's always in beta, and it's in beta for the longest time. But as far as anyone's concerned, as far as they're concerned, yeah, we call it beta, but it's in production. And you got a problem? Well, we'll answer your question one at a time when we get to it. And
no, they won't.
Well, they do once in a while.
No, they don't.
They don't.
They don't. If you contact Google and you say you need help on how do you do this or how do you do that or what does this mean, you'll sit back there and die an old man or an old woman before they come back at you.
And you wonder how they manage to be such a large company with such great influence with that kind of a business model?
I asked somebody how I could make use of the ability to upload an unlimited number of pictures to Google's cloud and not be charged for it. And I was told that I could use either a Nexus or a Pixel phone. And I said, yes, but how do I make use of this storage? And they said, oh, you don't. The phone does.
You know, Joe, one of the things that Google announced was that, as you probably know, they're into many different businesses. And one of the businesses they're in is called Google Fiber. And their first major project was they had put in internet into the town or city of Mountain View. And my daughter's familiar with that because she has a friend who lives in Mountain View and, you know, free service and all that. And they wired up all the streets and homes and so on. And everyone's happy, and I'd spoken to her was a couple months ago and says, isn't everyone happy? No, they stopped it. What do you mean they stopped it? Well, they finally announced that they're no longer going to be using cables. Now they're going to be installing, but from now on, everything will be wireless. And I'm not happy with that because with wireless, we are creating a different set of issues, like on security. And I just don't feel comfortable with it. But with Google, they can get away with it and say, you know, from this point on, everything will be wireless that they do.
And that'll simply mean that browsers like Opera will become more successful because the Opera browser offers you a free virtual private network, a free VPN.
Well, that's unless they start changing the parameters on that, too. I mean, with Google, I don't think there's any antitrust with Google right now.
Not yet.
But they seem to come up with standards, whether you like it or not. And as you know, they're very active right now in the driverless car. And my concern is everything is wireless. And if they're also involved with the wireless cars, I'm concerned with all the hacking that can go on.
Oh, Hank, you don't think anybody would do anything like that?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Hey, by the way, when we were talking about the, you know, hacking and so on, one of the things that many people have said to me, and you know it's not true, I know it's not true, is that they say the Mac is absolutely security-proof because there are no viruses for it. And hey, you know what? It just came out that it looks like many of the viruses that were hitting Windows have been recycled, changed, updated, and it appears that the state-backed Russians the tools that they were using, the whole repertoire of tools, has been transferred and converted to now hack Mac OS X. And I just want people that's running with the Mac OS X is that, hey, you've been living with the false concept that the viruses can't hit you. They can.
You got to be careful. The reason the viruses haven't been hitting you is the hackers were looking at the size of the audience, and they felt that the audience on the Windows side were much, much larger. But also, the Mac is a Unix-based concept, the way the operating system works. And Unix is a much more difficult system to try and use malware on. So in spite of the fact that it's more difficult, it's more possible if you have a whole community of people working to destroy it.
Joe, you'll find that the malware is less viruses and more phishing. In other words, by faking you out, and some of the stuff is so good, okay, you got to be very careful because...
Well, there's a lot of social engineering involved.
I had ordered some medicine online, and I got a notice that it got shipped, and it got a tracking number, and I had to, and then I got a follow-up message that they had trouble with delivery. Can I, give them more information? Uh-uh. But when I look at the address to reply to, it looked legitimate until I realized that... If you click on it, it gets transformed and redirected elsewhere.
It's a lot of the malware, Hank, is really very simply done in a way that they know that people won't look. If an address is, for example, put down simply as www.myaddress.com/127543, most people won't think more about it, but that 127543 is actually redirecting everything to downtown Moscow.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, you know, we have two feature segments that we're going to be running. One is on wearable technology with Dr. Alfred Poor, and Joe Rejeski has another simple computer tip for busy people. But before we get to that, I just want to mention that there's a website that I've been going through, and I find it fascinating. And let me just say that the URL on it is CDC, which stands for the Center for Disease Control, cdc.gov/500cities. And they got maps, they got 500 cities. And
Hank, don't even try to get into what it contains at this point.
It's fascinating information, though.
Make a point of going out to the site. Hank will repeat it in just a second. And then next week we'll ask you about it.
And Joe, I think he's still getting over the shock because I said to him, you know, you live in a neighborhood that's very healthy in terms of being, overall health. He says, yeah, that's good. That is, by the way, cdc.gov/500cities. And
is that numeral 500 or spelled as
500CITIES/? Okay, so let me repeat that again. www.cdc.gov/500CITIES. And if you live in a place that's marked black, don't smile.
Well, when he says marked black on the map, the solid color is. A solid dark color is the highly dangerous section to live in. Yeah. Hank?
Well, let's get to the Dr. Alfred Poor and Joe Rejeski. And now, Dr. Alfred Poor with this week's news on wearable tech.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. No, we're not taking a train ride this week, but that sound is there to illustrate the first thing we're going to talk about. I want to tell you about a new chip that Kyocera has created, which is designed to help measure the blood flow in your body. It's a non-invasive device, and it basically uses optics to measure how fast your blood is flowing under your skin. It's a tiny little device. It's about half the size of a grain of rice. It uses a thing called the Doppler shift. You may not be familiar with it, but if you recognize that sound clip of a train going by, you know that when a train approaches, the sound is at one pitch, and then as the train passes you and goes away, the pitch gets lower. Now, the reason for this is, relative to your position, the sound waves bunch up as they get close to you, and then as the train goes away, they get stretched out. When they're bunched up, they have a higher pitch. When they get stretched out, they have a lower pitch. A higher frequency, a lower frequency. Interestingly enough, the same thing happens with light. In fact, this is how astronomers determine how fast a distant galaxy is moving towards or away from our own galaxy. If it's moving towards us, the light waves get bunched up, the wavelengths get shorter and shifts towards the blue part of the spectrum. If it's moving away, then the light waves get stretched, the wavelengths get longer, and so it shifts towards the red part of the spectrum. All right, very interesting and simple stuff, but, you know, trains move fast, galaxies move even faster. We're talking about blood creeping through our veins and our arteries in our body. Well, in fact, this little chip, half the size of a grain of rice, is so precise, so sensitive, that it can actually measure the wavelength shift in light based on the speed of the blood moving through your arteries, which, if you think about it, is a pretty remarkable accomplishment. The chip is so small that it could be put into a smartphone. They could even be put in earbuds that you'd listen to music on your smartphone with. This is not some laboratory experiment. The company is planning to ship samples of the chip this year, and we could see this chip incorporated in commercial products as early as next year. Moving from something tiny to something quite a lot bigger, let's talk a little bit about exoskeletons. Now, there are lots of applications where you can use exoskeletons. They're not just for fighting space creatures, as was the case in the movie Aliens. They can provide a power assist or even help paralyzed patients walk. The big problem with them is that they tend to be heavy, they're cumbersome, and they tend to be very expensive to create. A company called Other Lab, which is based in San Francisco, they've come up with a device they call the ROAM, R-O-A-M, and basically it's a fabric design. It uses fabric with air chambers sewn into them, and then those chambers can be inflated or deflated, and that air pressure is used to create the power to power the exoskeleton. Another advantage here is that the materials don't cost a lot, and they're very easy to assemble, to manufacture. Just sewing, it's pretty simple kinds of techniques, very much unlike the precision machining required for some other exoskeleton designs, especially when they're using fancy metal parts and so forth. So this could be a low-cost and easy-to-make, easy-to-use exoskeleton design that could be used for seniors to help them sitting and standing. It could help those with physical injuries or chronic conditions, help them walk. it can even help workers in factories and other settings lift heavier weights and perform other tasks more safely. It's a lightweight fabric design that could help us become superhuman with a little bit of help from a Rome exoskeleton. You may have heard about cochlear implants. These are devices that can help people with impaired hearing to hear again by directly stimulating the part of the brain so that they can hear sounds. Well, scientists have been experimenting with stimulating other parts of the brain, in particular the vision part of the brain, in an attempt to help artificially stimulate those portions and help create the sensation of vision for those who've lost their sight. Their approach so far has tended to focus on implants. The problem with this, though, is that this is an invasive procedure. You're sticking electrodes and other components deep in the subject's brain, which isn't a great idea. And even once they get the implants in there, the body tends to reject it and build up scar tissue around it. And as the scar tissue builds up around the electrodes, they don't stimulate the nerves so well, and it reduces their effectiveness. A group of scientists have come up with a new approach that provides stimulation from outside the brain. They use micro coils. When I say micro, these are extremely tiny. They're about the size of a grain of sand. And they can be implanted on the surface of the brain. So it doesn't have to be invasively implanted inside the brain. It sits on the surface of the brain. By running an electrical current through the coil, it induces an electrical current in the neurons deep in the brain. And it can be done with a very precise location. So they can target specific parts of the brain to stimulate. They've done experiments with mice where they were actually able to control the individual whiskers of the mouse and get them to twitch on command. It works with great precision. The fact that it doesn't need to have a direct electrical connection to the neuron means that the entire device can be encased in biocompatible material, which reduces the chances of the body rejecting it. There's no electrodes involved that are going to become less effective if the body does decide to put scar tissue around it. This is a very interesting and intriguing experiment. It holds the hope of helping blind people see again, but it could also have other applications, such as it could provide sensory feedback for people with spinal injuries so that they could have a simulated feeling of their limbs, even though the nerve connection isn't there. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having their meeting on Thursday, March the 9th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in New York, and photo IDs required. TCF 2017, formerly known as the Trenton Computer Festival, will be held on Saturday, March the 18th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the theme of the festival will be autonomous vehicles. There'll be talks, workshops, vendors, and there'll be a banquet afterwards at the College of New Jersey. For more information, tcf-nj.org. And I hope to be there, and I hope to see you. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation on Picking the Best Backup Approach Thursday, March the 23rd, 7 p.m. It will be held at the Middletown Library in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC's User Group will be having a presentation on Perfecting Your Computer Backup, The Art of Backup, Tuesday, March the 28th, 7 p.m. Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on backing up your computer, Tuesday, April 4th, 2 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road, Ewing, New Jersey. Hey, I think I'm getting through to the clubs at least, and I hope everyone is backing up their data. And finally, the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be having their main meeting April 7th at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And from Joe Rujewski, another simple computer tip for busy people.
For this week's simple computer tips for busy people, our computer is saving us time, and then we're taking that time and throwing it right out the window. Hey, Hey, it's time for Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejeski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Here's a simple, cool computer tip you need to know. Now, does this sound familiar? Hey, Will, how's it going? Oh, busy. You? Busy. You know you've started many, many conversations with this script. I have. These days, it's almost required by law for conversations to begin this way. Everyone is busy. But are we too busy or too distracted? In our quest to work less, is the internet friend or foe? Shopping sites, chat applications, instant messaging, websites for our favorite sports teams, unmentionable websites, you know what I'm talking about, online games, videos on YouTube, pictures on Instagram and Facebook. It's easy to lose an hour or two and not realize how much time you spent with online distractions. Who hasn't said they're going to check out Facebook or a favorite website for only a few minutes and then wound up losing an hour or more? We've all done it. Are we so busy in part because we are losing a lot more time than we realize to online distractions? If we lose an hour a day to text messaging and Facebook and personal emails and YouTube and shopping websites, that hour is a pretty significant part of an 8 or 9 hour workday. For many years, none of these distractions existed in the workplace, so we needed to focus on one wacky thing, work, right? Does anyone remember the looks you would get if you were on the phone for longer than a minute or two at work? You weren't working. Get back to work, slacker. We need to ask ourselves, is access to all these diversions helping us finish work early? Well, do you have the courage to find out? Because if you do, the application Rescue Time, www.rescuetime.com, will monitor your computer activities and generate a report that lists how much time you are actually spending on different activities. You'll even receive a productivity score on a scale of 0 to 100 so you can see if you are improving. Now, if there's one thing I change about Rescue Time is your activity is transferred to Rescue Time's website so reports can be generated. Their privacy policy states that your information will not be shared without your consent, you can delete your data at any time, and they do not collect keystrokes, form input, screenshots, or anything nefarious. Also, you can pause Rescue Time at any time. Rescue Time is a great idea, and I'll tell you, it's well-reviewed. But I prefer it if I could just generate the reports without Rescue Time uploading my information to their servers. Am I being paranoid? Would you feel confident using Rescue Time with their assurance that they won't do anything nefarious? If you'd like to join an online discussion I started, visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com and let me know what you think. I love the idea of Rescue Time. I love it. I just don't want to trust that a company won't do anything nefarious with my data, but I don't know, maybe I'm overreacting. Let me know what you think. Anyway, another application is the application Freedom, and that's at www.freedom.to. Now, Freedom won't provide reports on your productivity, but it will block you from accessing websites you specify or the entire internet for a specified period of time. For instance, if you can't stop yourself from accessing Facebook for the next 4 hours, you can configure Freedom to stop you so you can focus on a project or whatever. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Are we too busy or too distracted? Am I being paranoid, worrying about my computer activities being monitored? Will I be wearing a tinfoil hat soon? I don't know. Let me know at www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rejeski, over and out.
Thank you, Joe. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay warm. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.